From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The White House is doubling down on President Trump's threat to shut down the southern border this week because of the tide of migrants trying to cross into the U.S. This weekend, White House aides said the president was not bluffing. Here's Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney on ABC's This Week.
Why are we talking about closing the border? Because not for spite and not to try and undo what's happening, but to simply say, look, we need the people from the ports of entry to go out and patrol in the desert where we don't have any wall.
Alan Gomez covers immigration for USA Today. Alan, start there. Shutting down the legal ports of entry to send agents out to patrol the desert. But critics are saying the huge tide of migrants coming are largely headed for the legal ports of entry seeking asylum.
They're heading to those legal ports of entry seeking asylum. And when they cross over, it's not a question of them trying to evade Border Patrol agents. They're actively seeking them out because they're doing so to request asylum. So, yeah, this strategy of trying to put more people in these unguarded, unwalled sections of the border doesn't seem to jive with what's happening now. Mostly what we're seeing right now are Central American families that are coming across the border. They're coming in groups of 200, 300, 400 people at a time. And yeah, they're not trying to sneak past Border Patrol. They're trying to find them.
Look, talk more about what just closing those ports of entry mean, not just for asylum seekers, but for commerce that comes through. The Washington Post is reporting that border officials have not received instructions on how to close the border. But talk more about what else is coming through there and what the effects would be.
Yeah, for the asylum seekers, the change wouldn't actually be all that dramatic because under the Trump administration, they've been doing something called metering, where they only allow a certain number of asylum seekers into those ports of entry to make the request for asylum. So I'm not sure how much this is going to slow or change in any way the numbers of people coming across. The impact felt here in the United States would be massive. Hundreds of thousands of people cross between the U.S. and Mexico every day. The State Department estimates that $1.7 billion in goods and services crosses that border every day. And it's important to note, it's not just for border communities like San Diego or places like El Paso and Texas. These are supply lines that travel through the entirety of Mexico and the entirety of the United States. Think auto manufacturers in the U.S. that rely on parts that are made in Mexico. Medical device companies that do the same thing. When you think of the groceries that you buy, a lot of that comes from Mexico. And so if there is a closure of all the ports along that southern border, you're probably not going to see your car prices jack up immediately, but your grocery bill may shoot up very quickly.
It's astonishing what happens on that border. A 2007 study from the San Diego Association of Governments and California Department of Transportation found that just long lines and inefficiency at the crossings cost $7.2 billion in lost economic output, 62,000 jobs on both sides of the border. They calculated the economic impact of an extra 15 minutes of border wait time was an additional loss of $1 billion in productivity. And now, this is talking about a shutdown. But there's also the White House threat to cut off aid to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Most of the migrants are coming from those countries. How would this work? Isn't this something that the president would have to go to Congress for?
Well, yeah, and that's where it gets a little bit complicated, and trying to understand the reasons behind it are a little bit difficult. As you mentioned, the Congress has the power of the purse. They approved this funding to go to grants and to all sorts of different financial aid to these countries. So it's unclear how a president can just unilaterally cut that off. I'm sure we'll be hearing plenty from Congress about that in the coming days. But separately is the wisdom of the move and what really would be accomplished, because this is money. We're talking about over $500 million a year that go to these three countries. Specifically to reduce violence, to help law enforcement battle drug cartels, to help their judicial systems battle corruption in those countries, and to help improve the economic and educational systems in those countries and specifically targeting at-risk youths.
And by the way, the money doesn't go directly to the governments. It goes largely to nonprofit organizations helping to fight corruption in the government, etc. And the State Department says it will work with Congress, but you're saying that the wisdom of cutting it off is what?
Is unknown right now. I really want to hear a more articulate explanation from this administration on why they're doing it, because Trump has tweeted and talked repeatedly about the leaders of these countries not doing enough to stop people from leaving their countries. But a president of Honduras cannot tell a Honduran, you can't leave this country. There are some things that, for example, Mexico could do to better seal off its southern border. But by cutting off all that funding, all that aid, I mean, I've been to these countries and seen computer labs for students that have been purchased with U.S. money. I've seen local community groups that have kind of formed around to create sort of community policing centers in certain districts. And so when you cut off all that funding, all of that goes away. And so it's very difficult to imagine a situation where cutting off all that funding somehow leads to the resolution that Trump wants, which is improved conditions in those countries, which leads fewer of them to want to leave to the United States.
Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. We'll, of course, follow this. Alan, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, even without a shutdown of the border, with the Trump administration's crackdown on immigration, many companies are finding it hard to hire enough workers. Case in point, the meatpacking industry, which relies on immigrant labor for dangerous work. Esther Honig of Harvest Public Media reports.
The JBS plant in Greeley, Colorado is massive, processing thousands of cattle a day. More than 3,000 people work here, and many are refugees, like Abul Basar.
Hello. How are you? Oh, thank you.
I met Basar at his apartment, along with his wife and two young children. He tells me he was violently persecuted in his former country of Burma, also known as Myanmar. He fled and spent 5 years running from country to country, eventually arriving as a refugee in Indonesia. He speaks through a translator.
So this time is the very difficult times. I don't have work over there, just eating, sleeping. That's it.
Basar finally resettled in Greeley in 2017, and his case manager got him the job at JBS.
It's a very hard job. It's very difficult. JBS, very difficult. It's not easy.
But it's one of the few jobs that requires little to no English and pays a starting wage of about $15 an hour. That's why, according to a study by the nonpartisan Fiscal Policy Institute, meatpacking has the fifth highest concentration of refugee workers, behind taxi and truck drivers.
I mean, refugees have been very good employees and are very good employees within the industry.
Eric Mittenthal is with the North American Meat Institute, which represents the meatpacking industry. He says plants are struggling to find enough workers due to low unemployment levels, but also because there are fewer refugees. Under the Trump administration, just 33,000 refugees were resettled here in 2017, the lowest number in almost two decades.
Well, I think as those general policies impact the overall labor market, then yeah, there's a tie there.
Mittenthal says the worker shortage means plants may have to shut down a processing line and can't meet production goals. Eventually, this could increase the price of meat in the U.S. and in the foreign markets where it's sold. Companies like JBS, which advertise hundreds of entry-level positions at its 58 plants around the country, are trying to attract more workers with free English classes, sign-on bonuses, and higher wages. Chris Tilley is a labor economist at the University of California, Los Angeles.
The economy has picked up. It's very different from what it was 10 years ago. And that means that all of a sudden, employers want to do a lot of hiring.
Tilley says there's a labor shortage across all industries. And he says President Trump's policy to limit refugee arrivals ignores the need for more workers.
The policy now is less a pragmatic one and more an ideological one. In some ways, making a point rather than serving a purpose in terms of how the country works.
It's also likely having an adverse impact on meatpacking, which Tilley calls jobs of last resort. The Department of Labor says the rate of injury for meatpackers is 2.5 times higher than the national average. Abul Basar says he spent more than a year working on the JBS production line, where he used a large electric knife to disembowel cow carcasses. After a few months, he says his hands began to hurt.
Show me what it is that happens. It gets stuck like that?
He tries to straighten the fingers on his right hand, but his ring finger stays bent.
It's locked, my fingers. Yeah, it doesn't work.
The interpreter, Sultan Ahmed, said it happened from making the same repetitive motion day after day. Despite his injury, Basar says working at JBS is his best option for supporting himself and his family.
he has to go to JBS because it is the easier one to get a job for non-English speaker.
The day after I visited Abul Basar at his apartment, we met up at a doctor's office in Greeley. Basar's here to see a hand specialist who will determine if he needs surgery.
I want to check in my fingers.
After a 20-minute appointment, Basar returned to the waiting room with good news.
Doctor says it's okay.
Physical therapy and a temporary break from his job on the processing line have helped. Again, Basar's interpreter.
It looks much better than before, so no need to have a surgery.
Abul Basar is visibly relieved by the news as we say our goodbyes. It was time for him to get ready for his 3 p.m. work shift at the JBS plant. For Here and Now, I'm Esther Honig.
The Wall Street Journal says this spring is shaping up to be the best in years for home buyers, thanks in part to low mortgage rates. If you're buying or selling a home, you'll probably take a peek at Zillow at some point. The company has been around since 2006 and offers real-time estimates of home values called Zestimates. Well, now its co-founder Rich Barton has returned as CEO. It's a job he left in 2010. He's come back to expand the company's mission. Rich Barton joins us now for our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top. Welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's great to be here.
And I guess I should say welcome back to Zillow. Also, what is it like to be back as the CEO of Zillow this year?
It's incredibly exciting. Zillow is a startup again. We are on the cusp of a whole new phase of the online real estate market where we're actually bringing e-commerce finally to this industry. And I couldn't be more fired up about taking the driver's seat back.
And why did you want to take the driver's seat back?
We're moving from phase one of this, in which we kind of turned on the lights in the room for real estate shoppers, helping them search and find. But what we're moving to now is finally taking this kind of Uberized on-demand customer who is demanding a much more streamlined process for actually conducting the transaction. And we are now bringing that to the fore. And that kind of a shift at companies might require the talents of more of a startup leader than an incumbent company. And so, you know, I'm bringing a kind of an insurgent's mindset back to the company.
Now, what you're talking about here is that Zillow is going to get into or is getting into buying and selling homes and also mortgage lending.
That's right. We are finally attacking the transaction. And we view mortgage lending, getting a mortgage, as an essential part of that transaction. Can you imagine taking an Uber ride and not having integrated payments? It wouldn't quite be so magical. And so we are working on digitizing the mortgage, making it a much more streamlined process, and making that payments for what we call Zillow offers. And not to mention title and escrow and all those closing services that most of your listeners out there, when they buy and sell a home, they're faced with this huge stack of documents at the end of the process that is confusing. And we're going to digitize that and streamline the whole thing.
And at this point, though, you're talking about actually buying and selling what on order of in the thousands of houses at a time? Or, I mean, how many are you going to get to it at a certain point?
Well, we have high hopes that there are lots of sellers out there. There's a really strong reaction we've had from sellers who are frustrated with this price uncertain, time uncertain, kind of people going through your house and through your closets when you have to show your home. People are really frustrated with that process. And it's a very appealing concept to have Zillow offers come in with our trusted brand and a fair price and say, hey, we will take it off your hands now or whenever you deem necessary, when you want to do the transaction, and we'll give you a fair price so that you can get to what you really want to do, which is get into that new place and start your new life. We think it appeals to a whole lot of consumers out there. We have guided through our investor communications that in the 3 to 5 year time frame, we could see doing $20 billion a year in sales, which would be about 5,000 homes a month. Mm-hmm. So we're ramping quickly.
And you wouldn't send people into the houses to look into the closets and all that sort of thing?
Well, we can do that once. We have our Zestimate a key feature of Zillow, which most every seller out there comes and looks at before they sell, is the Zestimate, which is the estimated market value of your home. Mm-hmm. And all of the smarts that went into producing a very accurate Zestimate are the same smarts that are now being applied to us formulating an offer for your home. We, of course, back that up with a human who sets eyes on it, but that human sets eyes on it once.
And that brings me to my next question, which is, will the offer that you make be the Zestimate?
Well, that's the psychic goal. That's the ideal. Ideally, I would like to have the Zestimate be a live offer for every house in the country. Now, it will take quite some time to get there, I think, Jeremy, but that is where we're headed. And the closer I can get to making the Zillow offer actually match the Zestimate, the more certain people can be about what their house is really worth.
Now, I can see this being great for Zillow in a great housing market. What about when the housing market is not so great? Isn't that very risky for you to be in the position of owning homes, you know, being the originator of mortgages, et cetera?
I guess the first thing is we think consumer demand is so strong for this service that whether it's an up or down market, there will be a lot of people raising their hands and saying, hey, Zillow, make me a good, fair offer. So that is not something I'm too concerned about. I think maybe what you're referring to is, hey, is Zillow going to get stuck holding inventory when a market crashes? And it turns out that even in the great market crash that we all love to forget, that's in our lifetimes in the global financial crisis, housing prices actually just didn't move that very quickly. They don't move very fast. And it's our intention creating Zillow offers to hold the house only for a very short period of time. We're really offering this as a service to sellers.
Well, then let me ask you this. Because you have so much data at your fingertips at Zillow, how would you describe the housing market right now, the health of it?
It's in pretty good shape, Jeremy. It is price appreciation is normalizing, even though we're still growing. Some of the hotter West Coast cities have calmed down. And so from a price perspective, it is normalizing. From an inventory perspective, we still have a way to go before we would get to what I would think of are much more natural inventory levels. Inventories are still tight. This is one of the reasons so many people feel stuck in their homes. It's actually there's just not that much out there to buy. And so the market's really not moving very well.
One of the descriptions I've seen of what Zillow is going to be doing here is flipping houses, which when a lot of people in this country, especially in cities where the housing market has been pretty hot, they look at flipping houses as one of the problems. It's driving up the price of everything. Do you see what you're going to be doing as flipping houses? And what do you think about that in terms of its broader effect on society?
No, I take great offense when people call us house flippers, actually. I'm kind of joking, but we're definitely not house flippers. We're not looking to take advantage of distressed sellers and make unusual profits. That's not what we're doing. We really want to have mass appeal for convenience and price certainty and to offer this as a service. I'll give you a for instance. My sister just recently moved from Raleigh, North Carolina to Chicago, and she has kids in school. And so many people are out there in this predicament where they want to have certainty. They want to know what they're going to get for their house so that they can move and buy their new house. And their kids are in school. They have to finish the school year. She ended up having to rent for 3 months a small apartment in Raleigh, North Carolina, after she sold her home so that she could park the family somewhere, have the kids finish school, and then go shopping for the new house. Mm-hmm. And what Zillow Offers is doing is going to short-circuit that process for her.
What do you think that what you're doing is going to mean for the broader housing market? Is it going to have a noticeable impact?
Well, I think the kind of mechanization, the kind of the bringing an e-commerce sensibility to real estate will certainly have broad impact. It will make the process much more efficient, hopefully much more enjoyable, much more self-directed in many cases. It will also mechanize the partner interactions you have with an agent when you go shopping so that the smartphone will be whispering in your ear all the time, hey, there's a new open house around the corner. Do you want to go let yourself in with this specially encrypted key that's going to get you into the house? I think that liquidity will increase. In other words, there will be more houses bought and sold because it's easier and the friction is less. These are kind of the grand visions, at least.
Well, and what do you think it's going to do to your existing business, which right now you guys make a lot of money by allowing real estate agents to put their smiling faces on the side of the screen when you look at a house on Zillow? If you're sort of a competitor to those people, what will that do to that business?
It really fits hand in glove with our current partner network that we have, because every seller, just about every seller, is a buyer. And that buyer is looking for a great match for a partner that is going to help them get into a better place. And so we have found that the new Zillow Offers business has been an unbelievable growth tool for our partnership network. And we see these two businesses operating hand in hand.
How much leeway do you think investors will give you? I was looking at the Zillow stock. I know that it went up when you came back to be CEO again, but it is down about 50% from where it was last June.
Well, it's going to be a process of educating our investors on the magnitude of the new opportunity. As I said, we see potentially $20 billion in revenues in the 3 to 5 year time frame. It's a different kind of business in that it's much higher volume, a real world business that requires lots of expense and operations and is lower margin. And so we have to simply educate and bring along our investor base to opening up their eyes to this new gigantic venture capital-like opportunity that our business presents.
Rich Barton, I finally want to ask you, you've mentioned Uber a few times in this interview, and people will remember that the founder CEO of Uber was ousted from Uber, and there was a whole big conversation about whether a company that, you know, was run by its founder could ever be run by anybody else. I wonder how you think about that. How are you going to prepare Zillow for the long term, for the moment when you do decide that you're going to leave for good and you want to put it in somebody's hands who can run it even though they didn't found the company?
I am a kind of leader who likes to paint a really clear and exciting picture of what the future might look like and then have fantastic partners and leadership team around me to go figure out how to summit that mountain, how to get there and make it a reality. I have never personally had a problem with succession, as is evidenced by, you know, the succession of leaders that we've had at Zillow Group. In fact, my successor at Expedia, I founded and ran Expedia many years ago, and my successor at Expedia is a guy named Dara Khosrowshahi, who is now the CEO of Uber.
Right. That is Rich Barton, who is the founder and CEO once again of Zillow. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy.
British lawmakers will vote again today on another round of alternatives to the Prime Minister's unpopular plan for Britain to leave the EU. Lawmakers have until April 12th to figure out what to do. And in the meantime, the British economy is losing nearly $800 million every week and has been since 2016 when voters demanded the UK leave the EU. That is according to Goldman Sachs, which said today that nearly 3 years of uncertainty over Brexit is weighing on the world's fifth largest economy. Here in house, Peter O'Dowd joins us now. Peter, you have been speaking with a business owner in Northern Ireland who's making arrangements for a no-deal Brexit. You met him in person back in November when we were in the UK reporting on Brexit. How is he doing now ahead of that new April 12th deadline?
Spoke with him just recently, and he is very nervous. And here's why. This is the poster child for what is difficult about Brexit. His Oyster operation is based in Northern Ireland, which is in the United Kingdom. It also spans, it's right along the border, it spans into the Republic of Ireland, which is in Europe. Now, right now, when we met, he showed me just how easy it was to take those oysters out of the water, move them to market in Europe. But if there's a no-deal Brexit, he is very concerned what that will mean for his future.
For 2.5 years, I put my business on hold just to see how this was going to play out. I really should have been expanding. I should have been employing more people. But it's all had to be put on hold, and I really can't survive this much longer.
Can't survive this much longer. So what's he doing now to get ready for a scenario where they can't find a way to approve a divorce deal with the EU?
And that's what he's planning for. And he's doing two big things. Number one, he's clearing out his inventory. So he told me he just rushed to hire a bunch of part-time workers so that they could take 6 tons of oysters out of the water far earlier than he would have done so earlier and get them to the market as soon as possible.
And the reason for selling them is that if there is a hard border, which I greatly fear, that means that I won't be able to move oysters from one site to the other, and things will come to a halt.
So he needs to make money now, because if there's a hang up at the border, he may not be able, those oysters might go bad, you know? The other thing that he's doing is he's sitting on a lot of money. He told me that he is not spending $130,000 because if there is a no deal Brexit, he's going to move his operations into Europe, which means that he has to buy a new location. He might have to shut down his operation in the north while he waits to open it in the south. He's got to buy new equipment. He might have to buy a new shed. But it means that he's not spending that money, and he won't spend it until there's clarity.
And it means, sounds like, that if he has the choice between having his business in the UK or Europe, he'll choose Europe because there's going to be more opportunity
if there's no
for
deal.
Him. What about that Goldman Sachs report that said today that the British economy is suffering because businesses are afraid to spend money?
You've got to imagine there's a lot of people just like Willie Lynch, and some of these are big companies. The CEO of Siemens in the UK said today that Brexit is making the UK a laughingstock and that it's making it hard for his company to invest in the United Kingdom. EasyJet, the British-based company, said today that its projections for summer travel are totally in the toilet because of the fact that ticket prices are going down. There's so much uncertainty over travel. And car production is down 15% in the UK in February, and it's been like that for months.
Get ready. I'm telling you, EasyJet is going to start charging people to go to the bathroom on the plane. It's coming. It's coming. They have a fee for everything else. Peter, as we said, some alternatives to the Prime Minister's plan coming later today. We'll keep an eye on that and bring our listeners the latest as it happens on Brexit. Peter O'Dowd, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we want to spend a few minutes today on the mounting legal battles faced by billionaire members of the Sackler family, owners of Purdue Pharma, which makes the highly addictive opioid medication OxyContin. They're being accused of helping to start the opioid crisis and then looking to profit from it by now providing addiction recovery, becoming an end-to-end pain provider, according to one document from the company filed in a complaint from New York's Attorney General. That complaint names individual members of the Sackler family as defendants and accuses some of shifting hundreds of millions of dollars from the company to themselves through a web of offshore entities. There are 1,600 other lawsuits against opioid manufacturers from cities, counties, states, and Native American tribes who say those companies aggressively marketed opioid painkillers and downplayed the risks. Herman Lopez is a senior correspondent for Vox. He covers opioid litigation. Hi, Herman.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us more first about Project Tango. This was the charge that Purdue sought to profit off addiction with treatments. A quote from a Project Tango document filed by New York's district attorney says that pain treatment and addiction are naturally linked, I guess like a couple dancing the tango. So tell us more about what we know the company said.
Sure. So the company, in essence, wanted to get into addiction treatment. And there's a really interesting graphic in this lawsuit that kind of shows like a funnel, which the top of the funnel is pain treatment and the bottom is opioid addiction treatment, which is interesting because it's kind of like a tacit admission that the higher use of opioids for pain treatment eventually can lead to addiction, which is something that Purdue Pharma and the Sacklers have kind of pushed back against before, that their opioids are leading to a lot of addiction and that they're partly to blame for the crisis.
Well, and a lot of this has been documented. In December 2016, Richard, Jonathan, and Mortimer Sackler discussed buying a company that used implantable drug pumps to treat opioid addiction. A lot of this is tracked through emails. We should say that 8 Sackler family members who are named as defendants in both the New York and Massachusetts filings said the lawsuits were filled with claims that are demonstrably false and unsupportable by the actual facts. But tell us more about this trail that district attorneys have of things the Sackler family, members of the Sackler family, have said.
Sure. So we've known generally for a while that there's this link. The first wave of the opioid epidemic was caused by the increased prescription of painkillers, and that led the drugs to proliferate all over the place, not just to patients, but also to people who bought the drugs from patients, got them from the black market, and so on and so forth. But in recent years, as people have investigated the causes of this, we've dug a little deeper into the Sackler family because they are the main owners of Purdue Pharma, which produces OxyContin. So in recent years, we've seen essentially that like Purdue knew that a lot of this was going on, that as its product was getting out there, as OxyContin was getting out there, there was more misuse. But they started punting on it. They would say, well, this is the fault of people addicted or misusing the drug, and we should put this on them. And these reports are really showing that, like, they were kind of working around the crisis as it came, that they were ready not just to deny that their product was causing any harm and, like, kind of pushing back against that, but they were also preparing for this addiction treatment side where, as the opioid crisis was growing, they were ready to essentially offer addiction treatment if necessary.
Well, and has been reported, these new lawsuits are largely notable for the fact that they do provide the family's continued push to sell these opioids, even as it became a bigger crisis, and even after the 2007 plea deal that the family made. Some are asking, well, you know, what is the evidence that they knew that OxyContin was this dangerous? Much of the evidence is this 2007 plea deal in which they acknowledged that they misrepresented the drug's addictive qualities. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So in 2007, the company did actually have to settle with the federal government. It got fined by the federal government for around $650 million, and its executives, three executives, got fined as well. And they actually were criminally convicted and had to do, like, community time for this. Essentially, the charges were just that it had misrepresented its product and had tried to suggest that it was safer and more effective than it was. The thing with that is, since then, the company seemed to continue doing a lot of this marketing for opioid painkillers, and the charges now are, look, we're still seeing the results of that marketing as we see rising overdose deaths.
And you talked about some of the things that family members said. Richard Sackler, overdoses are spiraling out of control. In the early 2000s, he wrote an email in 2001 urging the company to blame the patients. We have to hammer on abusers in every way possible. They are the culprits and the problem. They are reckless criminals. In 2009, this is, again, 2 years after that federal guilty plea in 2007, 2011, family members, you know, really hammered the sales staff. How do we expand the market for these drugs to capture more cost-sensitive patients, people who were, you know, didn't have as much money? You know, this drug obviously meant a lot to this company, but as you said, this family has billions. I mean, is it kind of head-scratching as to why they weren't looking for a way to get out of the business of OxyContin?
I mean, they simply saw a lot of money in it. And I think one of the worst parts, this is in the Massachusetts lawsuit, which is a little further back, but it essentially found that Richard Sackler at the time was writing to another company executive, another person in the company, and arguing that maybe OxyContin should be advertised as a non-narcotic in other countries. And you can say whatever you want about OxyContin. Maybe at the time they really did think it was going to be safer and effective, but to suggest that it could possibly be advertised as a non-narcotic is just ridiculous. It's an opioid. It's a drug that carries addictive and misuse potential. It's strange to me. In the 90s, there was a giant settlement with tobacco companies. And one of the things with that settlement is that a lot of the communications within tobacco companies were revealed, and that there was, like, really damning information in that. It's strange to me that Purdue wouldn't see that and the Sacklers wouldn't see that and maybe try to be a little smarter about what they're saying in their emails. And overall, I honestly can't say why they didn't try to get out of this. Maybe their move to addiction treatment was their attempt to get out of this or get into another part of this business. But overall, it seems like they just saw a lot of money in this and kept pushing it.
Well, Herman Lopez, we know that there are real pain patients out there who are very concerned about this. They claim that OxyContin is a lifesaver for them, but we also know that Purdue has been sort of ginning that up. Putting that aside for a moment, what do you think happens here? Members of the Sackler family are expected to respond publicly this week to some of the accusations in the lawsuit from the state of Massachusetts. We know that Purdue settled the first of their lawsuits with the state of Oklahoma last week for $270 million. Denying wrongdoing, unlike 2007, that is not that much money for this family. What do you think happens here, that they just settle lawsuits and continue? Where do you think this goes?
So right now there are a few state lawsuits in play. I think the biggest lawsuit to watch that's relevant to this is in Cleveland right now. Federal judges collected a bunch of cases, like hundreds and hundreds of cases. And the hope is that there will be a big settlement out of that that not only rewards money, which can then be used for addiction treatment to a lot of the places that have been affected, but also that pushes back on these pharmaceutical companies, not just the Sacklers and not just Purdue, but just opioid makers in general, and kind of lays the ground rules for advertising and that kind of thing. So this kind of thing can't happen in the future. But at least in the near future, it does look like the Sacklers are going to have to deal with a bunch of these lawsuits and probably are going to have to settle a bunch of them, simply because the effect of this advertising, this push for opioids that has led to the proliferation of painkillers, it really has caused a nationwide crisis. Every single state has seen overdose deaths increase since the 90s, and a lot of that is these painkillers. So until states feel like they have more of a handle on this problem, and until people feel like Purdue has properly paid for that, I don't see the lawsuit stopping.
It's interesting you mentioned that the company will be forced to do more treatment centers. In responding to some of the recent lawsuits, Purdue said that the lawsuits were ignoring the fact that the Sackler family has long been committed to initiatives to prevent abuse and addiction, citing a $75 million contribution to the research center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. But that was a condition of their settlement of the opioid lawsuit brought by the Oklahoma Attorney General against Purdue. They were forced to do that. Just fascinating. Herman Lopez, senior correspondent for Vox, covering opioid litigation. Herman, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks all for having me.
And at least one member of the Sackler family, Elizabeth, has reportedly called Purdue's role in the opioid crisis morally abhorrent. But another, the late Raymond Sackler, wrote a memo in 2014 pointing out how Purdue had successfully beaten back doctors who wanted to put caps on extended use of OxyContin.
The Real Clear Politics average finds 43% of Americans currently approve of the job President Trump is doing. 53% disapprove. Since right after he became president, Trump has been underwater in the average of polls. But recently, his approval rating among young white men without a college degree has been rising. It's up 22 points in the last 2 years, according to the polling data firm Civics. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York with more on this. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
And first of all, just lay out what this polling firm found about young white men without a college degree.
Yeah. So Donald Trump's average approval rating right now is about 42%. 6 months ago, it was about 42%. And 6 months before that, it was about 42%. So the top line numbers do not seem to be moving very much. But I was curious to know, all right, what happens if you dig one level deeper, particularly among young people? So as you said, I used this tool, Civics. It's a polling group that's a part of Coast Media, the liberal media company. It's an online poll that polls about 400 people every day. And I discovered that among young white men without a college degree, Trump's net approval rate has increased by a lot, about 20 points since early last year. So then I went one level deeper. I looked at young white men who are independents, who describe themselves as neither Democrats or Republicans, and their net approval of Trump has increased by 40 points since April of last year. So to make sure that this was real, I called up Drew Linzer, the head of the polling tool. He's a professor of political science at Emory University. And he told me, yes, the technology does allow for precisely this sort of close look at subgroups. And he runs external validation tests just to make sure that the polling data isn't an outlier.
And so
this is real.
So let's talk about some of your theories about what is happening here. First, you say this is about the labor market.
Yeah. So wages are rising, and they're actually rising fastest among low-income workers. So I'm thinking, you know, maybe people who are working in manufacturing and construction, they're benefiting from a tight labor market, maybe from new minimum wage laws, particularly actually if you're working in sort of a service industry like fast food or retail. So if you're looking at this group, young men with no college degree, well, you're looking at a group that might be benefiting from the best part of the Trump economy, or really the best part of the Trump economy and the late Obama economy, which is wage growth at the bottom level. And maybe they're associating increasingly that wage growth with approval for the president.
You also say that this has something to do with how conservative groups are using the internet. What do you mean?
Well, I think that when you're looking at changes in attitudes toward the president, you should look at economics first, but you should definitely also look at culture. And right now, I think we're in a period where you have this backlash on the right, particularly on the right that is really, really integrated into digital media, this reaction against PC culture, politically correct culture, that seems to have sort of accelerated since the Kavanaugh hearings. I read a lot of articles every single day about algorithmic nudging on Facebook and YouTube and even Instagram, where people who log on, who are looking for, say, movie trailers, 4 or 5 clicks in will realize that they're looking at some alt-right or far-right video that might have a conspiracy theory about the PC police of America. So I do think that in addition to the possible economic explanation, it's really important to also look at the fact that young white men, particularly without a college education, might be logging on to digital platforms and exposing themselves to media, alt-right media, that is making them more and more favorable toward the president.
Now, this also goes on the idea that the economy is the most important issue, which many pollsters will say it is the most important issue to most voters. But there are so many other things going on right now, the opioid crisis, immigration, et cetera. What are you seeing about what issues are most important to this group of people, young white men without a college degree?
That's a difficult question to answer because it's such a diverse group of people in terms of the interests that they might have. You know, if some of them are working in states where there's a lot of jobs available to them, then economics sort of might be less important as a fear. But I think it's really important to point out both the opioid issue and the immigration issue. I'm really curious. I'd be really curious to know. I think Civics is about to overlay the data they do have with state data, and I'd be really interested to see whether or not immigration is more salient for this group, for young white men without a college degree in, say, border states. Are they more paying more attention to the immigration issue and therefore leaning more toward Trump as they feel that the Democratic Party is abandoning them on that issue specifically?
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, and we will, as always, link you to his work at our website, hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.